Good morning.
Good morning.
You are listening to KBOO FM 90.7 on your FM dial in Portland.
91.9 if you're in Hood River, and 100.7 in Corvallis, Albany, Willamette Valley, in the ether.
This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott.
You were supposed to say www.kboo.
Oh, I guess I'm...
But he still is Cecil Prescott, and I am Celeste Carey, and welcome to More Talk Radio.
Tomorrow is Election Day.
Yes, it is. Have you put your ballots in, or are you like me, you're going to take it in so that you can feel like you're caught up in some synergistic energy that's either sweeping some change or keeping the momentum, or perhaps... Just holding back.
Just holding back.
Holding on.
Holding on. This morning, we're going to engage in some conversation about this election year and what's happening. We are pleased to have with us a journalist who has written extensively on many issues. And her most recent article that we will jump off from, begin our discussion, is about this year's election cycle. And... what it means. Joining us this morning is...
Okay, we have... is it Rinku Sen?
Yes.
Oh,
yes,
well,
exactly.
Great, great. I like to think that the brain and the mouth are working well today. Welcome. Thank you for coming on board. And you're an editor at Color Lines and write extensively about the backdrop of our elections and political change, and not just political change, but social issues. I've read some of your articles regarding immigration and others, and so we're really thrilled to have you on board and to talk about the backdrop, the significance of this election. Like, are there any particular groups that are significant to either maintaining the momentum that we think we have or possibly sweeping in some change that we might have to address?
Well, obviously the election is taking place between two parties, and there's a lot to watch there. The big concern for progressives is that Republicans will take over Congress, at least take over the House, and that they will then really carry out an agenda that is not so good for working people and people of color. They've already vowed to, do things like block the extension of unemployment insurance past November 30th, even though the recession is clearly still going on. Unemployment is still at a very high rate of 9.5% and higher in many, many communities. So I'd say in state houses and in Congress, as well as at the local level, there are lots of really interesting and live election fights, but many of them are really marred by racist rhetoric and by both Republicans and Democrats, in fact, playing to people's fears of the brown wave and scapegoating people of color instead of really looking carefully at the larger policy issues that we need to grapple with.
I think what you have been able to do is focus on the wave of racist rhetoric that has taken over much of the political dialogue in this country. And in your recent article in Color Lines, you highlight some of these incidents. And for me, at least, it raised a concern about the change that many people thought might have happened in 2008. It seems as if there seems to be a return, not so much of racist rhetoric, but a rise in the way in which people can freely utter racist remarks and things such as that. Is this something recent, or is this typical of American election cycles?
Well,
racism has obviously always been present in elections. And then in the 1980 election, for example, Ronald Reagan won in part because he invented this ad about the welfare queen and ran that everywhere and led Americans to think that if the Democrat was elected president, that, these sort of black women would take over all of public services and would defraud innocent American taxpayers. So that's always been a good sticking point for conservatives in both parties. I think what we've seen since the 2008 election, what I said in my article is that if that was an election where, you know, America seemed to prove that it was capable of electing a black man and getting over any biases that it might have, that the country might have, this election really feels like a recount. So what's happened in the 2 years since then is just a real ramping up, starting with attacks on President Obama that are extremely racialized, the questioning of his, you know, whether he, or not he's really an American or whether he's a secret Muslim. Those are racial codes for this man cannot govern you, this black man cannot govern us. And, you know, throughout the healthcare debate, for example, we saw members of the Tea Party spitting on black Congress members. We heard Joe Lewis call the president a liar during his healthcare speech. So that kind of attack on the president has really set the tone for the political debate, and that tone has now extended to the policy issues. You know, are we going to have health care reform? Are we going to reform the banks and the mortgage industry? What's the direction our education policy is going to take? All of those critical policy questions are really tainted by the notion that some of us just don't belong, brown people don't belong, and if we give them an opening, they're going to come and take everything.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here. This is More Talk Radio with Cecil and myself, Celeste. We're speaking with Rinku Sen of Color Lines, and if you'd like to join into the conversation, 503-231-8187 to discuss some of the factors behind this upcoming election. Join in the conversation. Lines are open now.
Speaking of the rhetoric that we see in this election cycle, and following up on your article in terms of where we are as a nation, I'm wondering, certainly there's can be legitimate criticism of policies, and this is not limited to Republican or conservative or Democrats, liberal or conservatives. But I think one thing that you state so well was how it has been racialized in terms of the discussion. I'm wondering whether or not this has been a means in which to animate some of the opponents of the president. Does it still work? Does racial rhetoric work to stir up the base, their base?
Oh, I think it definitely does. That's why conservatives use it. Interestingly, they sometimes use it against, supposedly in the interests of communities of color. So in Nevada, for example, Robert De Posada, who is a Republican strategist, has been sending around this ad, a commercial.
Not to vote. Yes.
Not to vote because they've been so betrayed by the Democrats, and they, you know, the answer is, the ad doesn't even say the answer is to vote Republican, because in fact they know, you know, Latinos overwhelmingly tend to vote Democratic, although their vote is up to persuasion like everybody else's. But the ad doesn't even say vote Republican, it says don't vote. So there's a lot of voter suppression going on, and I think that conservatives, and you know, this includes conservative Democrats, are really, they find that it works, that it draws people to them, and that it sets them, it gives them a persona of being the protector of the American identity, and that identity being white and Christian. You know, I live in New York, and through the summer for several months, we had just hysterical a debate, you could call it, I suppose, just hysteria around the Muslim community center that is hopefully going to be built on Park Place, the Park 51 project. And that was really, you could just see both Republicans and Democrats lining themselves up to prove that they were not soft on Muslims, you know, who they equate with terrorists and violence. And I think they do that because they know that that's going to draw their core audience to them and consolidate it.
I want to talk a little bit more about this idea of not voting. Do you think that's an effective strategy, not only when we need to maintain the few gains that we have or in the process of getting, but the fact that using a lot of this racially charged rhetoric polarizes people and it really kind of weakens any potential base you can have? I mean, I know there are people who are thinking that it's okay, you usually do lose a few seats during midterm elections. It may not be as bad as the media is portraying, because after all, the media can be a little self-fulfilling. You know, if it tells everybody, expect this, we're kind of conditioned to believe that they're telling us the truth. But right. Is there this whole strategy to not vote, isn't that kind of like shooting ourselves in the foot?
Yeah, it's really, really, really important to vote if you're eligible, and you know, to get yourself registered, get other people registered who are close to you, who you know. Sitting out the election is definitely not an option. One interesting.
Well, what's
thing
the strategy
about,
behind that?
Well, I think that you know, people are really frustrated with the two parties, and that's understandable. Mm-hmm. There's you know, very bad behavior in both, and sometimes it can be really difficult to figure out who's really on your side,
as
on the side of your community. And the important thing, though, I think, is certainly to vote and not to sit that out, because really the powers that be, whichever party they're in, they get to hold on to their power and to the status quo when people, particularly new voters, young voters, newly naturalized voters who are immigrants, when folks don't vote. So it's really, really, really important to get out there and vote and to help other people vote. One really interesting thing about all the predictions about Republican gains through these midterms is that most of the polls are based on telephone calls to landlines. And one of the things we know is that young voters, mm-hmm. and many, many people of color who are voters don't have landlines and don't get polled on their landlines. People of color are among the highest users of mobile devices like iPhones and, you know, smartphones. And if you polled cell phones, I think those polling numbers would be really different. So it's important not to get too caught up in the predictions that...
Yes.
There are going to be Republican takeovers everywhere, and that your vote won't make a difference. Get out and vote.
We're speaking this morning with Rinku Sen, who is the editor of Color Lines magazine. She has written a recent article on this election and the way race has played a role in it. One thing that I think your magazine does very well is look at the changing American demographics and how we are seek to become a more multiracial, multi-ethnic nation. And I was curious, and recently, in recent years, we've heard of so-called black-brown division and how there have been efforts to divide African-Americans and Latinos. One thing that I saw in your article that raised my eyebrow was the what's happening in Orange County with Representative Loretta Sanchez, and how she has went on Univision and sort of tried to raise her base by attacking her opponent, who is a Vietnamese American. Is that something that we should be aware of in terms of pitting ethnic groups against one another?
Absolutely. I think that's just such a convenient and irresponsible way to fire up a Democratic base. The ad was just did a lot of stereotyping of Vietnamese people and really kind of was based on the idea that Latinos are truer Americans than the Vietnamese are, and that it kind of raised these notions that the Vietnamese are going to grow in number and power and take over, really, what should be a Latino power base. And I think that the ad is a just quite an irresponsible way of helping communities of color think about each other and about themselves. Happily, there are lots of great local examples of communities pulling together, particularly to register people to vote, all over the country, in New York and California and Nevada and Louisiana. There are organizations, and I'm sure in Oregon as well, and in Washington State throughout the Northwest, organizations that are really multiracial, that are working very hard to pull together all of the people, all of the communities that are really disenfranchised from the system, and help them exercise their political power.
And we're speaking with Rinku Sen, editor of Color Lines. We have a caller online, and we'll go to that caller. Good morning.
Good morning. My question, I have a question and a comment, is that when Barack Obama was initially declared, or he decided he was going to run for office, it was almost as though the media gave him a push. And he was so publicized that I believe that the media itself energized, I think, a group of people who otherwise probably would have sat out. And I'm seeing just the opposite now. I think what you were saying about the polls is very true, about kind of if the media tells us it's going to happen, it's going to happen. And it's kind of interesting to me. And I really wanted to point that out, that I really believe this whole notion about not voting is just about, you know, not giving him that push in the media. It's kind of like, you know, free publicity. When he was elected, it was almost every channel you turned, Barack Obama, and it was like this push. And I think even his critics actually boosted him. And this go around, all I hear is criticism. And my point about, one of my point is the Tea Party. I think it's interesting that that they are here, and I think we need a voice like that. I think because it really points out what we are not having dialogue about. And I think this whole notion about white America and preserving it, I think just goes to show us how deeply rooted the problems that we have still in America. But my question is how do you see that in the media about them just not wanting to promote him and almost just bad-mouthing him to the point to where they believe they're not going to get people out to vote?
Well, I think that the conservative media has a lot of power, immense power. Over the last 40 years, one of the things that's happened is because of media deregulation, the number of companies that actually own the outlets on which we get our news and get our commentary and even get our popular culture, our sitcoms and our TV dramas and so on, those have really become the property. All of the outlets we have become the property of a very small number of companies. And those companies include the news corporations.
Hello? Go ahead.
Which is owned by Rupert Murdoch and which owns Fox News. And that conservative media really picks particular conflicts and particular fights, and it creates these themes, like this theme that Obama is a secret Muslim socialist foreigner. And those themes then get picked up, again, quite irresponsibly by more mainstream outlets like CNN or something like that. So the media does have enormous power, and I think that's partly why it's very, very important for communities to make their own media, which we can do much more easily and affordably than we could in the past because of the internet and because of new technology. That's really how colorlines.com, for example, has been able to get out the kind of reporting we do every day and draw a sizable audience. So you're absolutely, the caller is absolutely right that the media has a great stake in all of this and uses these kinds of conflict and these themes like the don't go vote theme, you're so frustrated, nobody's good enough for you to vote for a theme to reinforce a conservative agenda.
Well, just to really underscore what you're saying, Rinku, about the whole idea of media forming our opinion before it's even happened, Robert De Posada, who is the candidate who is running for office, he did vote. Now, he's the one who, the strategist who put together this whole idea of don't vote, and he claims that the Latino community needs to pay attention to this because Democratic leaders must pay for broken promises and betrayals. But he voted.
He did indeed vote.
You know, so we have to be careful because it's not only rhetoric, but it sounds like, well, just lies.
Yeah, do as I say and not as I do.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, your article, as we know we don't have you very long, but in your article, the title really is a call to action, too. And, you know, just with a day and a half or so left, the title says the most racist campaign in decades and what it demands of us. What does it demand of us besides vigilance and paying attention? Is there something else we can do to help be aware and to maintain the power base that we have amassed, even though it may not be as effective as people want it to be? What can we do? What does this demand of us?
Well, it really demands that our participation in the civic culture of the United States not end after Tuesday, you know, that we don't go vote on Tuesday and then kind of leave the government alone for the next 2 years until the next election. It demands that we get actually involved in our community organizations and in the policy struggles and questions that are coming up. Congress, the next Congress, and, you know, by extension, our state houses and local governments are going to be debating enormous issues over the next period. There's the question of what's going to be done with Social Security. Conservatives want to privatize it, and if it is, or in lieu of privatizing it, if they can't get that far, because, you know, people really love Social Security and rely on it and don't want to give it up as a public benefit. There's talk about raising the retirement age so that people will have to wait longer before they can actually begin to collect their benefits. Mm-hmm. There are still big questions about how we're going to manage the economic recovery, what kinds of unemployment benefits will be available to people, how we're going to reform the banks. And of particular concern to me is that the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act is going to be coming up, and that really is going to determine whether the kids of our communities have access to real opportunities for a full-out, modern, 21st century education. So folks, whether or not they have voted, whether or not they were eligible to vote, everybody can get involved in influencing Congress and our local elected officials toward doing the right thing. So it's going to be important to keep up with the policy fights, join the organizations that are in your community doing that, and make your voice heard, you know, in between election days and not just on those on November 2nd.
Great. Well, one final question before we let you go. In terms of eternal vigilance, what do you say to those who continue to be somewhat discouraged, who don't seem to have the energy to maintain that vigilance? What is one thing that we need to be aware of if or when, you know, you spoke about those important issues that the next Congress will confront? One thing that I don't think you did mention was in terms of the 2010 census. How might that impact where we go from here?
Well, the census, once the numbers come out, and after this they're going to be updated, not every 10 years, but region by region, more frequently than that, the census really determines how many resources communities get based on the numbers of people that they have. And so I hope that every one of your listeners participated in the census, filled out their form, because that is, and will continue to do that as the census gets updated over time. But really, it's important for us to stand up and be counted, because those counts really, they determine how many hospitals your community is going to have, how many teachers, whether or not the streets and the potholes are going to get fixed, some very, very basic things that we need just to get through life. So I suspect that the census numbers, as they begin coming out, will definitely get some attention, and that they're going to show the ongoing growth of communities of color in this country, and that those communities are going to have to be able to put a stop to, or at least challenge, racist rhetoric that is directed against them, not just during election seasons, but in between as policies are being debated.
And to remember that the number of folks that were counted by the census also determine what kind of, how many leaders we get to send to House of Representatives.
That's right.
As well.
Right.
And the more people show up, the more we have a good base to challenge any of this really divisive legislation.
Exactly.
Well, thank you so much. We hope to come back and visit you after the election to hear your thoughts on whatever changes come down the pike. And thank you for so much for your time, Rinku. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Rinku Sen, who is the editor of Color Lines, and we will continue our morning conversation about election 2010. We have with us Jamila King, who has written a very insightful article on the youth vote. Remember 2008 when it seems like everyone was energized and people on the street corners were getting together and registering
voted.
And youth voted
and spoke.
And it's 2010, and there seems to be a lack of enthusiasm. And what Ms. King does in her article is examine this phenomenon and help us to see where we might go in this election cycle and in the future. So joining us right now is Jamila King. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Just fine. Thanks for being generous with her time. And you talk about where the youth are now, and a lot of people seem to think that they're missing in action, but that's not true, is it?
No, actually, I spent a little over a week in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which in 2008 had the second highest voter turnout among folks under the age of 29. And it's very clear that people are still very much engaged. There was a really strong youth engagement movement before 2008, and it got stronger because of President Obama's election. And it's still going, and it's still going in spite of the fact that some people are very disappointed with the administration's progress, in spite of the fact that there's been many fewer resources given to youth groups to do the work that they did in 2008. But it's still very strong, and I think that that's something that doesn't get highlighted often when we talk about, you know, young people not being as excited about this election.
Let me back up for a minute, Jamila. Why and what are the resources that are missing from this particular election cycle that really support youth getting engaged and getting registered and getting informed about voting?
Well, I talked to some researchers who had done a lot of work in 2008, and one thing that they noticed is there's a lot less innovation when it comes to getting out the youth vote. And so I think there's been a lot of discussion around how this election is probably the most racist in years, and it's mm-hmm. very, you know, divisive. You have the Tea Party on one side, you have sort of left-wing folks on the other side, and that really turns young people off. I think that, you know, like, again, it's hard to compare 2008 because it's not every election cycle that you get someone as charismatic as Barack Obama running for president and the historic significance of that. But in terms of the resources that youth organizations don't have, you know, a lot of them are 501c3 nonprofits, which means that they can't openly endorse the candidate, which, you know, is fine. That wasn't the case in 2008. But it's also been the case that, you know, just getting creative in terms of how you get people to acknowledge you. So I talked to a lot of folks in Milwaukee who were doing really fun things like bringing artists from BET and MTV to town to host parties that would get people really excited about the election. There's mixtapes. There are ways to get people involved, because traditionally just cold calling a young person or even going up to them on the street isn't always the most effective thing to do.
With the youth being involved in a lot of the organizing, it would seem that some of these challenges might be overcome. And I hear you mentioning some really innovative ways of addressing youth engagement coming out of Minnesota, but what is there an overall slowdown, or is there an overall barrier that might be even diluting and diffusing the youth initiative and shaping the outreach efforts?
I mean, it's hard to tell in midterm elections. I mean, it's the case that traditionally midterm elections have far less turnout than presidential elections. But I think overall you have folks who just don't feel like they're being heard on a national scale.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, a lot of the issues that brought people to the polls in 2008, you had green jobs, you had education reform on the higher education and K-12 level. And those issues, and you also had the DREAM Act, which is something that a lot of folks
right.
that I talked to are really interested in. And those pieces of legislation have been sort of batted down, whether
right.
or not, you know, the Obama administration or Democrats have had the ability or will to stand behind them. People are really disenfranchised by that. People feel really let down by that. A lot of the legislative issues, a lot of the core issues that brought people to the polls in 2008 haven't been moved on or have been just flat-out defeated. So I think that's one thing, is just legislative inaction is really, you know, sort of trampled a lot of the progress of 2008, but folks are still working to sort of change that.
And is there any momentum? I think one of the things that fascinates me is we hear so many complaints about we're not happy with the administration, but during the Bush administration, we had no qualms as a people of getting out in the streets and marching, complaining, protesting, being visible.
Right.
And that energy, I can understand being frustrated, but I can't understand why people are not saying, maybe we need to go back to square one and get back out in the streets. And that's one of the things that people really do look to a lot of the youth to have that energy and that verve, you know, to accomplish. So I'm a little surprised in some ways. I mean, I know it's a midterm election, but the fact that a lot of the concerns have not been moved forward seems to me a good reason to get out in the street.
Right. And I mean, I think that's an issue that some folks are taking up. So for instance, you have folks who are working on the DREAM Act who for months have been sitting in legislators' offices, have been hosting sit-ins, but it's not as wide scale as we'd like it to be. And sort of in addition to that, you have this idea that, you know, this is our first black president, let's not make things harder for him than they already are. That doesn't mean that people won't be in the streets. That doesn't mean that, you know, people won't stand up for what they believe in and fight for more. But I do think that when, you know, you have a Republican president, when you have sort of a lot of the issues that folks were fighting against with the Bush administration, it's a little bit easier for like a coalition of liberal groups to sort of get up and say, we don't like this, but I think it's up to us to decide what we're for, like what do we want instead. And so when it comes to leading that discussion, when it comes to sort of setting that agenda, I think that just generally the left has had a lot of issues historically, and that's coming through right now. I mean, you have a lot of folks who are trying to bring together black and brown communities around immigration reform. You have a lot of just competing agendas and competing goals, and I think that it's happening slowly, but you know, again, it's up to us to determine what we want out of our president and what we want out of our country.
You're listening to KBOO FM. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. I'm here with my co-host Celeste Carey. We're speaking with Jamila King, who has written an article in Color Lines about the youth vote in 2010. We invite you to give us a call here if you have a question or comment and participate in our morning conversation. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. Continuing our conversation with Ms. King, recently we've seen in terms of the past couple of years, the rise of a phenomenon such as Tea Party and a lot of vitriolic rhetoric on the right. I'm wondering whether or not this has been an energizing or depressing thing that has happened towards young voters in particular. And then are there any counter efforts to for this right-wing Tea Party phenomena?
Well, I mean, I think it's been destabilizing for a lot of folks on the left. I think it's really difficult to see just sort of the racist ritual being put forth by the Tea Party. And it has, you know, really cut into the excitement of a lot of youth, especially when you go back to 2008 and see how energized and positive people were. But more importantly, it's tapped into why young folks don't want to go to the polls. They don't want to be part of these just really overwhelming conversations that are pitting one community against another, that really turns people off, that really kind of signals everyone to the worst part of politics, the worst parts of our democracy. In terms of what's being done to counter that, you know, we have a feature on colorlines.com right now about sort of left groups who are trying to kind of cut into that narrative a little bit. And so it's happening, but obviously it's not as wide scale. And mm-hmm. I think that one thing that's really important about, you know, the Tea Party and about how it relates to young people is that you have right now, like, our country is shifting toward being predominantly people of color, and that demographic shift is seen mostly in folks under 18. And these are folks who in the next 10 years will make up the largest voting bloc in the country. And so it's a fight over ideology, it's a fight over resources, and this is actually a really opportune moment for the Democratic Party to be reaching out to young people, to be cultivating that electorate, to be, you know, making sure that in the next 10 to 20 years you have folks who will, you know, vote for your policies, who will keep you in office. And so people are involved, people are trying to cut into that narrative, but obviously it's a very pervasive narrative, and obviously it's one that's very motivated to, you know, galvanize, you know, parts of the electorate that feel like they aren't being heard.
One thing that it occurred to me as you were making your comments in terms of what is wrong with our politics in terms of the rhetoric and how it turns off on many young people, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts or reflections on this weekend's rally in Washington, D.C. Was that an attempt to get beyond partisan rhetoric and the fact that we get much of our news from Comedy Central? Is that should be something we should be concerned about or celebrate?
You know, I think it's something that we should celebrate in a sense, and I say that a little skeptically, and only that we need our news to be accessible. We mm-hmm. need our news to be engaging. We need a narrative that's compelling enough to draw newcomers in, to draw young folks in. And that doesn't have to mean that you make fun of politics. That doesn't mean that you have to make everything into a joke. But I think if there's one thing that the wider media or even progressive movements can sort of take note of in what Jon Stewart and Comedy Central are doing, it's the fact that you really have to put forth a progressive narrative. You have to put forth an engaging narrative. And I think that we're doing that on some degree. And I actually didn't see the rally this weekend. I was in San Francisco. But, you know, like, people want something positive. People want to go towards something positive. We saw that in 2008. We've seen that with the Jon Stewart rally. And so it's really up to us to shift the narrative from something that's increasingly negative, that's increasingly, you know, Tea Party led, and actually have our own goals on the table. And so one small critique I have of it is that it's, you know, the rally was reactionary to Glenn Beck's rally that he held in August. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to see something that we actually initiate, something that we actually take on our own regard and, you know, take our leadership roles and actually put forth an agenda that we have the Tea Party on the defense.
Are Democrats and or Republicans moving over to allow young people take leadership?
That's a big question. I think, you know, in politics, it's usually an older folks' sport. But I think that one thing that 2008 really showed us is that there are new accessible ways to have a democracy. There are different ways to engage with that democracy. And so, you know, you may not hold elective office, but that doesn't mean that the community organizing you do in your community isn't making a difference. And I think that in that regard, there are being new spaces created for younger voices and younger leadership, and that younger leadership is still being cultivated in a lot of ways. But I do kind of worry that, you know, we had all this momentum in 2008, and we'll see what happens tomorrow in terms of how it stands up in 2010. But I hope that 2 years from now, when we're voting to elect a new president or keep President Obama in office, that we don't just tokenize the youth vote. And I think that's something that a lot of organizations struggle with, and it's something that a lot of youth themselves struggle with, is that in election years, you know, like, youth issues are a top priority, and then once someone's in office, we don't really care anymore. And so, you know, we do need a longer vision so that we have an agenda that has, you know, like, jobs on the table, full-time jobs, affordable education, the DREAM Act, things like that.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city. And we're speaking with Jamila King and talking about the youth vote and this midterm election. If you'd like to join in the conversation, do so at 503-231-8187. This is your opportunity. We're only on for a few more minutes. If you've got young people that you think are a little confused or maybe feeling a little challenged by this midterm election, or maybe just not hopeful and frustrated, period, this might be a good time to have them call and ask questions, get some answers, seek some political guidance. We know that jobs, we know that education, as you just mentioned, are important. We know the concerns about Social Security are also important. But are there any other issues that you can see coming down the pike that are really important to youth? I mean, from my perspective, I think a lot of the pending legislation and this this really divisive environment around immigration is really important to a lot of youth. But, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
I completely agree. I think that the mobilization around SB 1070, which is the sort of anti-immigrant, anti-people of color legislation in Arizona, has been a huge galvanizing point for young people. And, you know, kind of along with that, you have the DREAM Act, which would provide a path toward legalization for undocumented students. And so I do see a lot of momentum in those two fights. And I think that, you know, on campuses across the country, in cities across the country, it's very clear that sort of like the racial undertone to the conversation is very clear in those two fights. And that you have, you know, young people who are really in the spotlight. You have young people really having to decide what their priorities are and really taking action. And so I definitely agree that immigration is a top issue, along with, you know, the economy, full-time jobs, education reform. And, you know, increasingly it's at least in Oakland, it's been police brutality and police accountability on a local level. And so I think that those issues are absolutely important, but I do think that immigration has one of the most energetic bases right now.
Well, one of the reasons I can see immigration being a galvanizing force for young people is you have a generation of residents here in the United States who cannot become citizens because they may have turned 21 before they were able to get their citizenship, you know, due to the extraordinarily long wait, you know, in the process to become a citizen. Maybe their documentation arrived late. Maybe their parents had to work really hard to find the documentation because there's differences in how countries document their citizens. And so I'm wondering if you see any energy coming from young people to try to address that point right there. What can they do because they're in a citizenship limbo?
Right, and I think that that's a lot of the discussion. I mean, it's specifically around the DREAM Act, but you do have folks who maybe aren't going to college. You do have folks who want another path toward legalization in that regard. And I think very widely there was a, you know, like a fight over comprehensive immigration reform, and it had its pitfalls, and it definitely had its strong suits. And that's still an issue that young people are galvanizing with, and it's an intergenerational issue. It's an issue that, you know, whether you're in middle school or high school, you can bring your parents to a meeting, you can talk about as a family, and I think that that's an issue that specifically for youth groups is really important to galvanize around, because you have the potential to organize intergenerationally, and I think that that's very important for communities of color, and it's very important for building a strong progressive base when it comes to civic engagement.
We're speaking with Jamila King of Color Lines. She has written a recent article on the youth vote, and we will continue our conversation. We will go to our next caller online. Good morning, caller.
Hey, good morning. I wonder if Ms. King can speak to this concern that I have regarding youth. As you know, and as she has alluded to, demographics are changing, of course, in our country. They have been for a while. And people of color will probably, in the next 20 to 30 years, have a sizable majority. I wonder if we will, as people of color, continue politics as usual. I wonder if that can be addressed, because when we were outsiders, we had a lot of beef against the system because we were shut outside. And as we move into it, how are we different? How will we show youth a different path? We still do the same things as political communities have done at large in this country. We did partisan politics. We use invective. We use money. How will we change on a fundamental level how politics can be done in this country? Is that even possible?
Thank you.
You know, that's a great question, excellent question. And I think that it goes, well, first off, I hope that we change for the better. I hope that, you know, when you have a majority, a country that has a majority of folks of color, that, you know, people would be able to have a more inclusive democracy. But it's also important to recognize that just because a country is more diverse doesn't mean that it's any more equitable. And mm-hmm. So I think that one really important point is that, you know, the system of white privilege that this country was founded on will still be pervasive. You know, you have Fortune 500 companies now that have black CEOs and still do terrible things. And so, you know, I think that it's very important to continue to have these conversations and not get complacent as our demographics change. And as, you know, we have more presidents of color and as we have more leaders of color, I think that these conversations need to continue. And I think that they will ultimately change shape, but I think that they need to continue with the same vigor that they've had since, you know, for the past 50 years.
I think you just sent a terror note for some people, as you mentioned in passing. As we have more presidents of color and more mm-hmm. leaders of color, I see some people saying, oh, no, that's a problem. But we'll go to our next caller. Good morning. Good morning. We have one more caller.
Good morning.
Yes, you're on the air.
Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a member of KBOO and progressive, and I want to give people a reason to vote. I'm in my mid-60s, Vietnam vet, and I'm a voter activist. I get a lot of, especially young people, to register to vote. And my comments are that we got to remember that we're about 330 to 350 million people in this 50-state, that's just the 50-state empire, and we are the third largest empire in the world, and gee whiz, yeah, there's corruption, and that doesn't mean that we can lay down and not get out and vote at the very minimum. And also, we got to remember that I get mad at the Democrats, but hey, it's a winner-take-all system. We don't have any proportional representation. And we got to remember that it was the progressives behind the Democratic Party that are responsible for winning the rights of women to vote, veterans benefits, Social Security, workman's compensation, unemployment insurance, Social Security disability, civil rights, voting rights, Americans with Disabilities Act. I'm sure I'm missing a lot of things.
Sure.
But
I think we get your point.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I think the Democrats do a poor job, so we have to do it because we're we the people, on selling the Democratic Party as a reason to vote to the alternative, winner-take-all system, which is the Republicans, which have gone so far to the right that they're dangerous. And thank you very much for listening, and take the comments off the air. Keep up the great work. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you for your call.
Jamila, does the appeal to partisan poly politics appeal to young people?
You know, they do, but I do think it's a little overrated. I think that repeatedly when I've talked to experts and political scientists and organizers and young folks themselves, it's been the case over and over that people vote on the issues. So, for instance, you have in Wisconsin where I was, Russ Feingold, who's an 18-year incumbent who often breaks with the Democratic Party line, and he still has a lot of support in Wisconsin, but, you know, that he's in a really, really tough race right now. And so I think that that's the case in several different states across the nation, and it's not directly due to young people not supporting them, but I think it's important to realize that, you know, Democrats have to earn the respect of young folks. They have to actually, you know, move legislation. They have to, you know, it's not just voting on party lines. It's not just sort of like a blind electorate that's just going to follow, you know, whatever lead. And I think that's potentially dangerous if we continue to operate that way.
Well, I know that a lot of the candidates and some of the party leaders try to court people. I mean, there's a lot of courting of the black vote. There's a lot of courting of the Latino vote and other demographic votes. But you don't really hear of anybody really pursuing the youth vote very much. Now, is it because of this kind of aversion to partisan politics that you don't hear of really large concerted efforts, or is it more of youth saying, we dictate how you come to us?
I do think that young folks are a little bit more, you know, active in that narrative, in that battle. So I do think that last part of your question is true, that young people are sort of saying that, you know, you need to prove yourself to us before we can vote for you. But I also think that the youth vote is traditionally looked down upon. People don't invest a lot of energy into it. I mean, in fact, when President Obama made that a huge part of his campaign in 2008, people kind of thought he was crazy because young people don't turn out to the polls. But actually, there's, you know, a think tank in Washington that does a lot of work on youth civic engagement, and they found that it's probably more cost-effective, I mean, the bottom line, in the long run, for folks to target young people, because who you vote for when you're young is most likely the party that you'll stick with throughout your life.
Right.
So, you know, if you're courting younger voters right now and, you know, say they're 20 or 22 and 20 years from now, you know, that makes a huge difference. That means that you don't have to invest so much energy in trying to convince middle-of-the-ground voters to vote for you. I think that people are a little bit more informed, and I think that people are you know, definitely more on board with what you're doing and have more familiarity with the party.
Mm-hmm. After tomorrow's election, regardless of the outcome, some people are going to be disappointed. Some people are going to be wringing their hands and saying, what next? Where do we go from here as we geared up towards 2012 in terms of activating the youth base?
Yeah, I think that it's important, and some folks in my story actually said this too when I was reporting, that the young organizers now are really trying to build a structure and a path for 2012. But I think it's also important, and this is something that a lot of community organizers told me, was that election years are important and who we have in government is important, but we should be harnessing that same energy every day to participating in democracy, to trying to change our communities, to trying to hold elected officials accountable. And I think that that's a struggle that doesn't just happen in election years. I think it's one that we have to continue to build every day and every year. And so, you know, continue to get involved no matter who's in power. I think, you know, conservatives are in power, then that's even more of a call to action. But if Democrats are in power, that's a call to action too, because we have to hold folks accountable.
Well, thank you so much. We've been speaking with Jamila King. Any last words you'd like to offer as we wrap up the show?
Yeah, we will be covering the elections from a race and public policy angle at colorlines.com. We hope that you'll come and visit and comment if you feel so inclined. And I hope to talking with folks more soon.
All right. Thank you. We'd be happy to have you come back.
Thank you.
And we've been speaking with Jamila King and earlier with Rinku Sen of Color Lines Magazine, which is a very powerful magazine, you may see it online, that talks about the intersection of race and politics and in terms of how we as a nation continue to change and evolve. Tomorrow is Election Day. For those of you who have not yet voted, it's probably time for you to vote.
Yeah, I'd say. It's like, so get your ballots out, get them marked, put it in your bag. You don't want to mail it. You want to take it down. I don't think you have enough time to mail it.
Yeah, and for those of you who are places other than Oregon, you go to your polling booth tomorrow.
Yes, your polling booth and get to mingle and create change or maintain momentum.
Well, regardless of who wins this election, we will see you next week, and we will continue our conversation about change in America and the world.